This podcast is brought to you by American Dope. This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store. This podcast is brought to you by American Dope. 1973, the Detroit Free Press's front page proclaims, "Dope kingpins get away with it." They had names like Jesse James, Pretty Ricky, the Black Greek, and Mr. Clean. Two of the 12 men listed as Detroit's biggest heroin dealers were next-door neighbors, and in reality, they were the two largest heroin dealers in Detroit, dwarfing the other men on the list. Eddie the Fat Man Jackson, charismatic son of a pool hall owner, and his chief lieutenant, Courtney the Field Marshal Brown, a former city bus driver, had built an empire on a par with men like Nicky Barnes and Frank Lucas of New York. But theirs was a very different and in many ways more sophisticated operation than Barnes and Lucas's, based on family ties and finesse more than murder and mayhem. They truly were the Motown Mafia. And the saga of Eddie Jackson, Courtney Brown, and their families stretched from the 1960s and into the present day. Starting in 1969, Eddie Jackson had built a tight inner circle of lieutenants like Charles Rudolph, Russell Clayton, Ronald 5-0 Garrett, Black Butch, and his right-hand man, Courtney Brown. All of them had grown up together in Detroit's old Black Bottom and Paradise Valley neighborhoods, forming an unbreakable foundation for their soon-to-come heroin empire.
Well, we all grew up in the same neighborhood. They call it Paradise Valley.
I came to Detroit from Alabama in the late 50s.
So when you looked at Black Bottom, you looked at musicians, but you also looked at more. You had a spirit of great entertainment.
The saloons and nightclubs that once made Paradise Valley's Hastings Street famous around the country are long gone now, replaced by urban renewal and shining new stadiums. But when Eddie Jackson and his crew were growing up, it was the heart of a vibrant community.
A lot of Black folks were there, and they needed the very essentials that most communities need. They needed good housing. They needed to be able to maintain those houses. They needed employment. They need social relationships. All of that took place in Black Bottom.
During this time, you could leave your doors open.
Being a young boy growing up in the Black Bottom, you know, we talk about neighborhoods in the good old days. That was a neighborhood. When they talk about leaving your door open and the lady down the street or the man down the street will whoop you for doing something wrong.
You would go out if you were Caucasian. You would party in other parts of Detroit. But after midnight, if you really wanted to have a party, you really wanted to eat good, you came down to Black Bottom. And the senselessness of crime didn't exist. They weren't going to rob you, they enjoyed you.
I met Eddie Jackson, he lived around the corner. My sister used to rent from his father.
Eddie Jackson and Courtney Brown first met in the late 40s when they were kids and formed a fast bond.
So Eddie had to be at least 5 or 6 and I had to be at least 10.
Their father didn't let him go anywhere unless Courtney took him. You know, so he looked up to Courtney.
I met Eddie when I was about 6, 7 years old.
I used to rock set him because he was sort of heavy and I was little and he couldn't catch me. But I loved him because he was always a cheerful guy.
Eddie Jackson's father fled the South in the 1920s, possibly after some trouble with the law, and became a prominent businessman in Paradise Valley.
The audience needs to understand the significance of Black entrepreneurship that was not considered simply a doctor or a dentist, that there were businessmen.
Eddie's father was a very successful businessman. He's one of the few Black, he couldn't sell liquor, but he had beer and wine license back then because it was during the war.
He came to Detroit from Hot Springs, Arkansas. He was a different guy down there, but he changed his name. He had killed someone.
You had Black men who were independent, like Mr. Jackson and others that were coming to the community. They ran legitimate businesses, but sometimes they also ran, like, the numbers business.
Bought a Lincoln Continental with push-button windows, which was unheard of in 1947, 1948.
made his fortune, or the beginning of his fortune, selling homemade liquor. Put that into real estate.
While Paradise Valley was relatively safe in the 1950s, there was a thriving but well-controlled underground economy in effect.
Now, you also had your red light district, so there was a great hypocrisy also.
There was drug addicts then, there was alcoholism and all gambling and all the rest of it. But as kids, we was no-no.
Money everywhere, nothing but hoes and pimps at the time.
Because you had strong prostitution. So I'm speaking of white businessmen, white factory workers and others would come over to the house of ill repute. So Black Bottom was a spiritual, a social enactment, more simply than just economic.
Even though we was poor and it was hard times, I always think pleasantly, you know, back from that time.
It all balanced out very well. And then suddenly it got blown up.
This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. By the early 60s, Paradise Valley and Black Bottom were fast becoming memories as urban renewal cleared the area. Eddie and his brother Elijah took over their father's pool hall when the elder Jackson died. Charles Rudolph joined the military, and Courtney Brown got married, started a family, and became just another working class guy in the ultimate blue collar city.
Then I got married in 1961. My daughter was born later on that year, Christmas. My son was born 3 years, 3 days later, on the 28th of December, 1964. Started driving the bus at DSR.
Little did they know, Detroit's fortunes were about to take a turn for the worse, but Eddie Jackson's fortunes were about to take off.
The city had started to slide, but you couldn't see it yet. It was just barely beginning to go down.
I don't think you can ignore the social levies that broke in 67. I mean, they were coming all along. But once that riot broke, then the social norms and the parameters changed immensely.
The Detroit riot of 1967 was by far the worst to hit the country during that time and was the final nail in the coffin of Paradise Valley.
As governor of the state of Michigan, I do hereby officially request the immediate deployment of federal troops into Michigan to assist state and local authorities in reestablishing law and order in the city of Detroit.
The city had gone from the land of opportunity to a nightmare of unemployment and blight. Then the heroin moved in.
The heroin is so strong over in the Orient, you can't snort it, you can't shoot. They were smoking. Guys came back with a habit. The local drug couldn't support it.
When Eddie Jackson's father died, he left his sons Eddie and Elijah a substantial inheritance. But by 1969, the money was long gone, thanks to the brothers' penchant for the good life. Eddie went to work in an auto plant, but was injured.
The insurance company won't pay me. So you got a pretty good understanding of the procedure. Why don't you read these papers and see?
Eddie enlisted his childhood buddy, Courtney, to help him receive a disability settlement and used the proceeds to make his first foray into the heroin game.
He gave me $800. Then he turns to me and said, Courtney, I'm going into drug business. I say, is you crazy? I say, what do you know about drugs, Eddie? And for him, you can make a lot of money.
I'm the original. As far as selling drugs for Eddie Jackson, I'm the first guy that ever did it. Me and Sidell Kincaid. At the time, Eddie was just hustling around the pool room, you know, and hustling crap games. And he went and bought a little stuff and put it in the building across from the pool room. Me and Sidell went to selling it.
Which I don't see Eddie again for another couple months. I comes back down there and he tells me that the guys ran off with his money and he broke again. Well, I filled his income tax out. So I filled his income tax out. He went back in business again.
Guys ran scams on us. Sissy Sam and Buddy. They used to sell the weight down in the valley. So Eddie thinking he under the impression he buying a quarter pure because he getting him $250 for it. It's not pure, it's mixed jive. Saying so me and Cedell, we struggling selling this, you know.
Eddie kept at it, parlaying his income tax return into another small load. This time, he started making money.
I was visiting Eddie once, and he had a guy over his house, was a heroin dealer. He had an Eldorado, a guy named Young Blood. he was snorting some heroin, and I was looking at him hard, and Eddie hunched me and said, "Don't look at the man like you crazy." This guy had a grocery store, drove an Eldorado, was real sharp. He was dealing drugs, because I was over there helping him cap up dollar caps. They used to call them penny caps.
While the Italian mafia still dominated the heroin trade in Detroit, by the late 60s, black dealers were striking out on their own. Chief among them was Henry Marzette.
Now, in my research, we go back to the 50s and found out that heroin was there. You start talking about Henry Marzette.
Marzette was really the first urban godfather here in Detroit,
who was a police officer and then became the man in drugs. But he wasn't the only one.
He was kicked off the police force in, I believe, 1956 or 57 for shaking down numbers operators in Detroit as well as drug dealers and purveyors.
I knew them. I ain't like need them. I knew them. I knew all of them. See, my vet and them was into murder and kidnapping and all that.
As a police officer, everything he learned about the drug game, and now he was going to apply it to himself, becoming a godfather.
I was given money as a young man on Washington Boulevard by Henry Marzette. I had an uncle who was a major player, and I was bedazzled by Marzette. He was wearing house shoes. He had a black Fleetwood, 1965. He had a black Fleetwood Cadillac that I thought was the coolest car in the world. And he gave me money for school, and that's what he said. The money wasn't for me to go and get clever in an Italian knit. He gave me that money, and he said, "Then I expect for you to go and use this for school and nothing else."
Eddie Jackson's meteoric rise in the dope game came when he met a shadowy figure in Detroit's underworld, John Klassen.
Marzette had the name, but actually Klassen was the guy who really had the weight.
The Italian mafia around here in Detroit had really been the primary wholesalers dating back to Prohibition. You had men like Giovanni Papa John Prezzola and Raphael Jimmy Q, or Jimmy the Goon Quazzerano. Mr. Quazzerano, as well as Mr. Prezzola, had very, very solid ties over in Sicily, as well as ties into the French connection.
Klassen had met a connect out in Oak Park, some Italians.
Klassen was being fed top-quality heroin through Sam the Mustache Norber, a remnant of Detroit's infamous Jewish purple gang.
He was getting some of the best dope in the city. No question about it.
This territory was always recognized nationally as not just a hub for Detroit Italians, but a hub for national Italians to get their drugs.
So we were scuffling and scuffling with it, you know, and we did this for like 4 or 5 months.
In 69, Eddie Jackson finally caught a break. A well-known junkie in Paradise Valley by the name of Box claimed he could hook Eddie up with someone big.
Box, he was just another average guy, man, Eddie, who happened to know Claxton.
First thing, Box said, "Man, give me a blow, I'm sick." Eddie said, "Man, you ain't done what you say, man. Don't worry about it, man, no big man, don't worry about it. Who is this guy you talking about?" "John Claxton. Man, and you a junkie, and you don't, I know him. He just bought a house in Palmer Park, cost $40,000. I said, "Man, ain't no nigga got $40,000. So sure enough, he did know Claxton. He took Eddie out there. Eddie came back with some jive. I look at the package. I think it's sugar or flour. I say, "What is that?" He said, "That's dope." I say, "Man, a person pay you for this shit?" He said, "Yeah." They start capping up the jive. I'm fascinated because I've never seen heroin or cocaine in my life. I'm 30 years old, never seen it. And he said, "What are they doing?" He said, "They're capping up these penny caps and they sell them for a dollar a piece."
With Eddie now being supplied by John Klassen, his operation took off. And soon Eddie could be seen riding the streets in a brand new red convertible Cadillac.
I was working at a gas station on Gratiot and Madison. Eddie used to come through with them Cadillacs and stuff, you understand? Which, you know, every black guy, you understand, wanted to drive a Cadillac. And I used to tell Eddie, let me hustle with him. He said, "Man, you know I can't hustle with you because, you understand, you know your mama would kill me."
Eddie come flying around the corner in a 1969 red Cadillac convertible, brand new.
San Mateo red, I never will forget it because we had went out to the car dealership out on Grand River, and he had picked that car out when we had first started, and I was like, "Man, you ain't finna make that kind of money to buy no Cadillac, you know, because I'm not thinking that big, but he is." And when I came home, he had that Cadillac.
Get in the car. I said, I'm not getting in the car. It's stolen. And Lodger, his brother, laughed and said, no, Eddie just bought it at Coffee Cadillac for $6,900. I said, $6,900? Yeah, he paid cash for it.
Once Eddie hooked up with Claxon, he started getting a product that he could work with, you know.
Seeing his buddy's business was now booming, Courtney Brown decided to supplement his day job by moonlighting with Eddie.
My mother and father had separated, and my father went to stay at his house on Mark Twain Street. And that morning, I woke up in the morning, and I hear these men talking in the kitchen. And I peeped in the kitchen, and it was a pile of white substance on the table. I had no idea what it was. The pile had to be like 4 feet high. But my father, he ushered me back in the room.
Eddie soon assigned him the task of finding an apartment building he could purchase to use as a headquarters for the operation. Courtney found it on Hancock Street in John R. in Midtown Detroit.
They was getting a little bigger. They opened a place on Hancock.
He kept saving his money, and then he bought that building up there on Hancock, and then he started selling quarters.
They wanted somebody that could come and pick up the money. And Courtney was already working with them.
He said, Berman, you 5-0, y'all can stay upstairs then. When they ask for the dope, y'all drop it down there and he bring y'all the money.
As Detroit was changing and crime was skyrocketing in the city, the Hancock building quickly became one of the city's most thriving heroin spots.
On my shift, I would open the door, customer give me the money. I would go up the steps, put the money through a chute in the door. They had made a pipe in the ceiling. They would drop the dope down right in front of the door. The customer would pick it up. I took their money, but I never hand them any product. Then I would open the door and let them out.
With the Hancock Street building, my father was the caretaker there. And I used to come visit my father. And at this time, Courtney and Eddie used to be in and out of the building. And so they gave me the job, but when I get out of school, to come over there and vacuum the floor, you know, tidy up the building, outside the building.
Penny caps downstairs, and we'd sell what we call weight then, was like a gram or 2 grams, 8 balls.
Penny caps, which is dollar caps, out the back door, and they were selling half, quarters, and eighths out the front.
The drug deal is the first time that we began to see money that was well beyond pimps. You started seeing a different type of young black man. You started seeing Mercedes Benzes. You started seeing a Rolls Royce occasionally.
My father used to tell me, do not go in the basement. But me being a young guy and, you know, being mischievous, I go in the basement anyway. And I see the same thing again. AMP bags full of money, but only this time, another section of the basement had AMP bags with these little brown packages in them, with what we known as ACE. And each bag was filled all the way to the top.
First time, we made $1,000. We thought we was doing a hell of a thing. That was 69. The first time we ever made $1,000 in one day.
I just seen people come there and get packages. Learned, you know, a whole bag full of ACE. You know, I never seen nobody come get a single nothing.
Violence and other problems were avoided by strategy and focus. Eddie Jackson ran things differently than most dealers. Customer service was his number one commandment.
We didn't have security problems at the joint because only one person, you couldn't come in three people and only one person buying. That doesn't leave room for a robbery on that part.
On the average, we was doing $10,000 a day. On the weekend, we do $15,000.
So you needed 2, 3, 4, 5 people to be going through at different times, picking up the money.
We had guys working 3 shifts, they just like they working the 4. We paid vacation, they worked 8 hours a day, they got paid for overtime, and we had a bunch of law workers.
My father would call me and say, the fat man wants you to go to the store for him. I used to have to catch a bus from Lafayette and Shane all the way to Hancock and John R. just to go to the store for him for an orange pop, and he would give me $100.
As the Hancock took off, an arrangement was made with the 13th Police Precinct to provide protection from raids in exchange for a share of the drug proceeds.
After the business really got big, police used to come once a month to get paid.
This paid off when Eddie and Courtney got tipped by the Detroit police of an impending raid by federal narcotics officials.
They approached Eddie and told him, said, look here, man, we get word that they're going to raid because they heard there's a big dope house on Hancock.
The local cops told the dealers to leave a small amount of heroin packs in the spot, but diluted to less than normal strength. So when the feds came, they'd think the Hancock building was just another small-time operation.
Showing up, they raided that night. Showing up, they find the few packs that we left around. The workers, seen they were just junkies, let them go.
But he was a thinker, and I think that's what you saw, a thinker minus the violence, temporarily anyway. When I said that, he knew how to move his kilos, he knew about connections. For the first time, we were seeing young black men with an option of, you can do this, not be on Wall Street, but you can do this and be a thinker. And that was very different.
He was always, he was the businessman. He was always, people was coming talk to him, and he was like, he was giving directions. He was like, he was the facilitator.
I never seen Courtney do a whole lot of talking and stuff. He was always smooth.
You know, I didn't never see him get loud with nobody. I never seen him with a confrontation with nobody. He was always cool. A well-oiled machine all the time.
People see Eddie as a great businessman, which he was, and he got this from his father. But I've always said myself, Eddie was an expert on understanding human nature, and a lot of people might not remember well enough to give him credit for that.
And that's one of the standards that Eddie would always apply. Look at, you do not mistreat the customer, period. If they ain't got no money, enough money, so what? You take the $8 and ride with it and call it whatever it is. His philosophy was this. As long as I get 95% of the money, I could care less about the 5%.
This is another reason probably that kept a lot of things from happening to him, is how he didn't get played out his life, because a lot of drug dealers did.
No harassment, no talking about them, no degrading them, and not trading sex for favors, sex for drugs. If a woman come in there and they have no money, you can't tell her to have all sex with you and you'll give her the credit. That was a no-no. If you cut that, you was fired.
I didn't been in situations where a guy might owe someone some money and he can't pay him. And he's like, well, you got your daughter in the back room. Let me go back there with her. And, you know, we'll kill this bill. We never did nothing like that.
Though the money was beginning to really pour in for Eddie and his crew, Courtney Brown decided he'd had enough and went back to working full-time as a bus driver.
I went on back to work and bought a house on Mark Twain. For a whole year, I didn't see Eddie there.
By 1970, Eddie was one of the biggest dealers in the city, and Courtney was growing tired of the street life.
Later that year, 1970, Halloween, I don't know, I came to a crossroad in my life. I said, well, if I go back to work for the state or go back and hustle with Eddie, I decided to go see Eddie. And he said, you can help Rudolph, 5-0, and Russell and Fairlee mix up. I was behind in my house note and all that, and he said, don't worry about it. I'll straighten it when I get back.
Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.
Every street between here and Port America Park, it was a joint, and everybody was getting money. Everybody was getting money at that time. This was in, like I say, 69, all the way to the early 70s. No guy selling drugs or make as much money as he was making because we were selling mixed jive. That's where your money was made. That was quinine, Dorman, and lactose. We would take a key and make 9 keys.
Just as Courtney returned to the crew, John Klassen, Eddie's main supplier, disappeared. Under indictment and facing a lengthy jail sentence, he fled Detroit and became one of DEA's number one fugitives. Klassen was never seen again. Eddie continued to briefly do business with Klassen's wife, but he desperately needed a new source for heroin if he wanted to keep getting rich. Eddie had a plan.
They did just granted Ali his license back to fight.
This podcast is brought to you by American Dope.
And it, the buzz was everybody's going to New York. When Eddie goes to the fight, he goes dressed all up and drives his Fleetwood van to the fight.
Eddie Jackson and his entourage made such an impression at Madison Square Garden that Ebony Magazine published a photo of them alongside the now infamous shot of Frank Lucas in his chinchilla hat. In New York, Eddie, so the story goes, bumped into some Italians, most likely members of the Bronx-based Gambino crew that distributed most of the French Connection heroin entering the country. The Italians observed that Eddie appeared to be in the same business as them and that maybe they could work together.
He comes back. So we meet, he said, look here, man, I met some Italians and they say they letting the stuff go for $16,000 a key. He asked me, he said, what do you think? I said, Eddie, you know more than I know. He said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to send Dolph up there with $50,000 and get three keys.
Eddie didn't know it at the time, but he had just made one of the great connections of the golden age of heroin.
Back at the hotel room, I put the heroin in the clothes. When I get on the plane, I put it in the overhead compartment. And it was just that easy.
Realizing the gold mine they had on their hands, Eddie and Courtney began flooding the streets of Detroit with their new product.
That was my first job. Transporting. From New York to Detroit. I would take 2 or 3 million at a time.
Every couple of weeks or month, we would make a trip up to New York and cop and come on back.
I never had no problem because, like I say, hey, we was protected from the time you stay, I pick it up to the time I get across George Washington Bridge.
As the organization grew, Eddie stuck to his old circle of childhood friends from the bottom.
When I came home from the joint, that's who he had around him. He had 5-0, Rudolph, Courtney was there, and Russell was there, yeah. That's who he had around him.
Everybody had a bag from different people, you understand, that was getting it from Eddie. At that time, Eddie was supplying, if not everybody, direct or indirect.
Eddie had an uncanny ability to inspire people.
He had a very good grasp on human nature. You know, what people might do, what people want to do.
He would say, look here, man, here's a couple ounces. Then after that, he'd say, you ain't no half-ounce person. You're a half a kilo man here. You know, pay me, you know, when you get training. And Eddie started him off from the ground floor up.
Eddie Jackson's legend was growing in the streets just as fast as his bankroll.
Well, first of all, I told you he was a people person and loved the people that was his audience. His customers and their family and kids, even people that wasn't his customer. You didn't have to be his customer to be in his audience. You understand? All you had to do was catch him on the right day and be there and you was on. You was finna see something that you probably ain't gonna witness again in your lifetime. A lot of stories other people told to me because he was sort of bashful in telling me this. When he came home, we'd go out hanging together and other people come telling me stories and he'd sit there kind of bashful. That's my, did you really do that, Pop? You know how that is, you understand? Niggas push a button on me and at that time, I had to be Superman, you understand? When they pushed that button, I turned into Superman, you understand? And that's how it was.
We've turned the corner on drug addiction in the United States. Drug addiction in the United States is under control.
Richard Nixon might have thought he had the country's drug problem under control, but he certainly didn't have Eddie Jackson under control.
It was Eddie Jackson's crew, and then it was just everybody else that probably got stuff through Eddie Jackson.
Everybody in the city knew Eddie Jackson, and everybody knew he was on top of the pyramid. I was his right-hand man.
Well, yeah, he was real charismatic. You know, wore diamonds, flashy stuff, wear his hair in this Superfly hairstyle and so forth.
Ain't nobody compared with Eddie Jackson since Eddie Jackson left. He could be emulated, but never duplicated.
He used to come to the joints that I used to be at and buy everybody everything they want and give us some money to do the same thing. Open up the crap table and have us to gamble with him. Yeah, he beat us all because he keep on betting. And sooner or later, he going to throw a 7 or something on us. And he turn around and give us all back the money that he gave us and leave out.
If he go out, he rolling. Okay, I'm gonna take 250 people. I got $1 million to blow. We all gonna go down here and blow this $1 million together. So we all going to the fight. We all going wherever we going. Nobody gonna be shortchanged. You ain't got to worry about being hungry if you got enough money to gamble.
Eddie was an entertainer. He entertained us. When he walked, he talked shit all the time.
He have a bag full of $1 bills in the car, because all the $1 bills that came from the joints and from the streets, he throw that away. You know, he ride down the middle of the street and just throw that out the window.
Throwing money out of the car, down in the Brewster Projects.
Yeah, he used to ride down John Arne, throw money out the window and everything.
Yeah, like we'd be riding down the street, not don't have nothing to do. And we have a sack of money. Eddie said, man, we just take this money, just throw it out the window, ride down Woodward.
Just go crazy, grabbing the money and so forth.
Yeah, stampede, you understand, people running, turning cars over, trying to get the money.
All the $1 bills ain't keep them. He kept $100 bills in his pocket. You know, he said, damn, we got all the $100 bills in America.
I remember Eddie giving a lot of people money and say, we need you, turn them on to the business.
And then sometimes the personal ones, he would stop and ask you, you all right? You say, yeah, well, I'm all right. It's going in his pocket. Ain't telling what he might give you. No telling. And that was a life that they don't have now, you know.
This is another reason I believe that he threw the money out of the car, because he appreciated his customers. He also knew without his customers, even though they was using heroin, it would be no him.
What these men represent was a new way of entrepreneurship and also what you did with that money. They're the ones that started showing up at the fights that were Ali and Frazier. They were the ones that were traveling for the first time. We never saw that before. You're talking about travel. You're getting your Cadillac and go to Chicago. You're getting your Cadillac, go to Alabama. But suddenly, these young men that had drug money, and it spread very quickly. The girl like, oh, I want to get with, you know, Eddie or whoever, because they're going down to the Bahamas. Some of them were talking about going overseas. They were really just a whole new frame of thinking that the black community had not seen before.
We'd have been Amsterdam, Holland, Paris, France. Be true, was I was the only one really traveling with him, you understand, going around, you understand, country, you know. A few guys went with us, you understand, but like I say, most of everybody else would get homesick, sick, and me and him be keep on going. It was beautiful. Whenever you see a black guy, whatever, the way we was dressed and the way kind of jewelry and stuff we had on, they thought we was entertainers or something, you understand, but we wasn't, you know. South America, from Rio de Janeiro all the way up to the Panama Canal.
By 1971, Eddie and Courtney's crew were so legendary that when Courtney bumped into prolific black author Donald Goines, a Detroit native and heroin addict, Goines told him that the streets of the city knew that they were the best that ever did it in the heroin game. Goines even based many events in his novels on the real exploits of Eddie Jackson and his crew.
He said, I come from the old school and I've been seeing it all, from all the guys who so-called from Marzette to Nick the Greek, to John Claxton, the whole crew. And as far as we're concerned, y'all number one.
With their strong plug to the French Connection heroin pipeline, the Jackson organization was operating at the absolute highest levels of the drug world.
It's a very complex subject, I would say, but it is a time that was, I think, revolutionary. These new men came on the scene and they were doing cutthroat business, but they were businessmen. No different than Al Capone and company during Prohibition.
This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.
Along with men like Nicky Barnes, Frank Matthews, and Frank Lucas's supplier Ike Atkinson, Eddie Jackson was on the short list of most powerful black gangsters in the country.
There's only was two or three people that I tell you black were dealing with. Eddie was one, Frank Matthews, and one of them, Frank Goldfinger.
September 1971, the Jackson organization suffers its first setback. Eddie's girlfriend, Farrah Lee, is spotted at the airport traveling with two men and a large sum of cash to New York.
When they get to New York, the DEA was tipped off by the clerk at the airport there, a black woman and two black guys had large sums of money going to New York. She calls my house and tell Eddie she got the package. I tells Eddie to tell her don't go back to the airport, get away from the airport. So anyway, she gets to the airport, they stops her. She had 2 kilos of heroin. She refused to cooperate, period. She wouldn't tell them nothing. But one of the guys, Reynolds, who was with her, told the DEA that she was working for a guy named Eddie Jackson. She was his girlfriend, and that's what the dope was going to.
With Lee incarcerated and Eddie's name now known to federal drug agents, the field marshal, Courtney Brown, was dispatched to New York to deal with the problem.
When Eddie got ready to post the bond for her, they said no, that they gonna do harm to the girl if she got out, to tell Mr. Jackson to post another $50,000 if he wanted the girl out. So I flew back to Detroit, picked up $50,000, took it back to the bonding company. The girl got out.
After being hooked up with F. Lee Bailey's legal partner, H. Ross Black, Fair Lee was finally granted bond. But Eddie Jackson and his crew were on the feds' radar in a major way.
They gave her 7 years. She done 3 years or something like that.
With all the heroin they had coming in, Eddie decided to get out of the retail business and become strictly wholesale. He called a meeting at Courtney Brown's house.
He calls a meeting, Charles Rudolph, Ronald Garrett, and myself, and Eddie.
Eddie figured he had went as far as he could in the business that way.
Meeting in my kitchen, Eddie announced that he's getting out of that part of the business. Y'all can have it. Y'all can split it up among yourself. You can be your own boss. He says the only person got a choice in this is Courtney. He can stay with me or he can be his own boss, and I can understand that. He said, plus, y'all been good law workers. I'm gonna give each one of y'all $10,000 apiece. Y'all free to do what y'all wanna do. The business is y'all. As of Monday, I'm through with it.
Myself, 5-0, we set our own operation up. 5-0 had his crew, and I had my crew.
Him and 5-0 feuded a lot. They started that price war thing and ran the price of stuff down to half a quarters for $20, and they was just...
Instantly, my business took off. 5-0s took off anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000 a day.
Rudolph was my man. He would drop off the big bags of quarters to me, big shopping bags full of quarters, and pick up the shopping bags full of money.
I started off with 5-0, Ronald Garrett. And like I said, he was the fool out of the whole group. You understand? I'm talking about knocking police out and all that. And like I say, when I started off with him, you understand, I stayed in jail, you understand, fighting the police with him. I mean, he used to knock them out 2 and 3 and 4 at a time. 5-0, he was a renegade. I used to pick up his money. Anywhere, you understand, never less than $50,000, you understand, a day.
By this time, Eddie himself was grossing roughly $2 million a month, over $10 million in today's dollars. Triple that figure by the time Rudolph, 5-0, and others sold it in the street.
Eddie, by that time, after the Italian man, Eddie had shot past everybody in the city put together. And when we knew we could dump 10 kilos at one time. And we gonna see the guys for 2 weeks. I go collect the money. 2 weeks, they get another package.
Insulated from the streets, Eddie and Courtney spent their time with family and hobnobbing with every black celebrity that passed through Detroit at the height of the Motown era.
And he'd come down the Heat Wave Bar, was off right off of Vernon in the expressway. He's sitting there with, it'd be a gang of people out there waiting on him, and they'd close the bar down so he can eat chicken in the basket. That's all he would want, chicken in the basket. And then, goddamn it, he'd have to sneak out the back door. And the goddamn Rose or one of them would pull up in the back and pick him up. You know, cause Eddie looked out for him, so they would see if they could get a few bucks or something. Basically, he did give everybody something. If he said that he'd come see about you, he'd have somebody, he'd have Butch or one of them to come find you and give you what he said.
I'm not there to glorify, but it was a time of wine, women, and song. The entertainers wanted to take pictures with the likes of those men, like Eddie Jackson. So you'd see the OJs and the beautiful, like Phyllis Hyman, They were the ones that would go to the little private parties after a concert, and those men were an elite group.
Red Fox crossed paths with Eddie and Courtney at a show in Detroit, and they showed him all the best hospitality.
And he said, well, where y'all guys from? We said, Detroit. And then he said, you know, I like that white girl. The white girl? Well, me and Eddie looked at each other. There's a lot of white girls around here. We know you're talking about cocaine. I'm having a new TV show. Yeah, what's named Stanford and Son. So when he got his cocaine, he had his own personal suite up in the Pontchartrain.
It was once said that 80% of Motown music at that time was done under the influence of Eddie Jackson's drugs.
Anytime any entertainers came to the city, we were supplying them with cocaine because we was giving it to them. Richard Pryor, the Dale, the OJs.
You knew Ouija of the Dramatics, Eddie Kendricks.
You name them, we served them. And they got it all free. Because me and Eddie used to buy 2 and 3 keys of cocaine just for our personal.
By this time, Eddie was more of a celebrity himself than many of the Motown acts, and he floated through the streets like a movie star.
There were these names of guys who also hung out with the very stylish and important men who were part of Berry Gordy's Motown. So you're looking at Holland Dozier Holland. Those were young men writing songs, making money. So you had this whole image of cool that had changed.
But back then, it wasn't about no territory. It was about having a good time. Who was the sharpest? Who had the biggest diamond ring?
While the Jackson Organization handled their business like a Fortune 500 company, most of Detroit's other dealers seemed more concerned with murder than making money.
It was coming up in the paper then. People was getting crossed out their life, you know, and large sums of money missing.
By 72, Detroit's murder rate led the country, and Detroit had become known all around the world as the Murder City.
The 750 murders last year was a record for Detroit, murder capital of the country. Detroit's murder rate is twice that of New York and Chicago. It is four times that of some cities.
And for the next 2 to 3 years, you had an all-out drug war in Detroit.
Drug pushers, procurers, killers are considered heroes of sorts.
I was headstrong, so murder or shooting and all that was the norm for me. So, but that's what me and Eddie wouldn't agree at. The guys I was running with, that was the norm for them. But Eddie wouldn't ever tolerate that. And
a lot of people that I've spoken to have referred to him as the gentleman gangster. You know, the guy that was street savvy, that knew how to make a living on the street in the underworld, knew how to, you know, the ultimate politician, meet the right people, make the right connections, and make everyone happy, and do it all without having to really brandish a gun.
Somehow we avoided all that. We knew who the characters was. But they said they wouldn't bother us, and we didn't bother them.
He fancied himself a businessman that happened to sell drugs as opposed to a psychopathic drug dealer killer that happened to also kind of dabble in business.
While Courtney and Eddie were able to steer clear of much of the killing, they were also prepared and ready to deal with dangers that lurked in the murder city.
Somebody had mentioned to somebody else that they was going to rob it because he used to wear diamonds and stuff. I remember they were shooting at the people down the alley.
I remember this one guy, he had robbed Eddie a couple times over there in Chicago, where Fairlee used to stay. He caught Eddie in the hallway and they robbed him once, took the jewelry and stuff. And he caught him again and he had robbed him. Eddie had told him, said, look, man, I hit you a couple of licks, you know, I know you a hustler just like I'm a hustler, but we cut this on out. So dude didn't pay heed. So, you know, he came up on the missing end. You know. He was one of the main figures that the stick-up men and all that wanted to get.
Everybody knew in the city, also called bad guys, good guys. 5-0, Charles Rudolph, Courtney, Eddie, ain't nothing to play with. If it come down to a gunplay, they ain't scared to do what they got to do.
They were players, and they were also part of urban legend. There would be a lot of younger guys looking at them. They would watch who Eddie Jackson. They want to see what he was wearing. If he wore a certain style, even if they couldn't afford it, it's kind of like the Nike commercials with Michael Jordan. Be like Mike. They wanted to be like that gangster. And he was the man. And it wasn't a lot of puffing up. I never even saw anything remotely close to violence, because those guys were too smart. They didn't do anything about it.
Relative house of man's to allegedly conduct some business with this guy, Norman Burton. And him and I was in the kitchen talking. A friend of mine was with me, named Joe Weaver. He overheard a conversation. He didn't get all the conversation, but it's enough to alert him to come in the kitchen and call me aside. I say, Courtney, this guy talking about robbing us. I said, give me the pistol. So I came back in the kitchen, and I didn't even have to ask questions. I put it to his head. And I said, I should blow your goddamn brains out right now. And he pleaded me, George, get Courtney, man, I ain't done nothing, I ain't said nothing. So I said, that's the only way you ain't dead now.
December 1971, Courtney and Eddie receive a huge load of heroin from New York.
December the 14th, the Italians called me and say, tell your man, Eddie, everything is straight. Eddie and I have a meeting to plot how we gonna do this. We agreed that we weren't going to go back to this address on Hubble, 19315 Hubble.
Unknown to them, in the 3 months since Farrelly's arrest at the airport with 2 keys of pure heroin, they had been under constant surveillance and wiretap monitoring.
Got 12 kilos. We're going to cut it 10 times at a minimum. So that would have been 120 kilos.
Just as the cutting process of the pure heroin began, federal agents burst in the stash on the 19,000 block of Hubble in Northwest Detroit.
It was the last day of the wiretaps. Eddie and George Blair gets on the phone and tells 4 or 5 people that the dope is there. Here the police, and then all the hell broke loose. Eddie and I runs upstairs, because it's upstairs. We see the dope not put in the stash like it's supposed to be. The guy who's supposed to been watching, Reggie, went down watching television and was watching the door.
22 kilos of heroin were discovered, which stood for 40 years as the largest heroin seizure in Michigan history.
Eddie threw the dope up in the air. It was so strong they had to get gas masks. So they arrested us, all of 5 of us. Eddie paid everybody bond. We bond out. When they raided Eddie's house, my house, and they don't find no drugs or nothing. But when Eddie's house found a lot of paperwork from real estate he owned.
Free on bail, Eddie and Courtney laid low for several weeks. But in January 72, a massive 32-person indictment came down on the crew.
I remember I was at home. I got a call one morning, and I answered the phone, and then they hung up. And the next thing, the dough went crashing in.
After everyone was picked up by the feds, Eddie hired famed civil rights attorney and Malcolm X's confidant, Milton Henry, to lead the criminal defense team and bailed out all 32 co-defendants with his own money.
That was it. It was a 16-count indictment of manufacturing and distribution of heroin and cocaine.
The indictments did little to slow down the Jackson organization.
A side note to the Jackson story that I find interesting is that most of Jackson's biggest making months or years were at the time that he was dealing with a lot of legal wranglings. He was under several indictments under the same time that he was making himself the biggest wholesale drug dealer in all of Detroit and possibly all of the Midwest. So that's a very fascinating aspect of it.
The Italians called, you know, always checking on us. We informed them what happened. They said, don't worry about it. Send your man back up here.
With the heroin still flowing, Eddie and Courtney got right back to work.
Then they came back with 2 kilos. Out of the 2 kilos, we made 30 kilos out of it. But everybody then got busted and is scared to deal with us now because they bust. So for about 1 or 2 weeks, I mean, we couldn't sell nothing. Then about 2 days later, Eddie come by my house, blowing the horn. Boom, Berman, here. I said, what? Gave me a bag of money. I said, what's this? $60,000. Man, this guy named JC is flipping his stuff. So from that on, things picked up.
Despite their legal troubles, 1972 and 73 became the biggest money-making years for the crew. Eddie Jackson decided to buy a home, which he tore down and rebuilt, in one of Detroit's most exclusive suburbs, the mostly Jewish city of Southfield.
When Eddie moved to Southfield, he said, I want these people to know I got some help, and I want y'all to come out here every day.
Eddie then made Courtney his official partner in the business.
Why don't you move out here with your man? I said, move where? He said, Southfield. I said, I can't afford to live in Southfield. Y'all work for you. Oh, Berman, fuck that shit. All right, here, I tell you what. From now on, you ain't on salary no more. You get percentage of whatever comes in. See, every time something comes in, you get X amount of dollars. Now, can you afford it? I said, yeah. He said, all right, then.
I remember vividly when my parents told me and my sister that we were moving to Southfield and that we were going to be moving next to Eddie. And I knew Eddie from coming by when we lived off Outer Drive on Mark Twain. We went out to Northland Gardens and, you know, he's got this Olympic-sized swimming pool.
While Eddie focused on the streets, Courtney focused on his family life.
Paid cash for the interior decorator, cost $50,000 for the interior decorator. Paid $65,000 cash for the house. Bought three new cars, jewelry and stuff.
You knew once I saw the new neighborhood we were going to be moving into that this was a lot nicer than the way most people lived.
First time I walked in their house, I'm talking about it, it was like it was magical. Yellow carpet, piled the blue furniture, and a black baby grand piano. I didn't see stuff like that on TV. And there's a stairwell leading up, stairs to the bedroom.
Smokey Robinson down the street, Pete Moore, Dot Netta, one of the Holland Dozers in Holland.
At this time, there maybe have been six black kids in the whole public school system. And most of all their parents were professionals, pharmacists, doctors, or lawyers. There was a few of the Motown people who stayed around us, Smokey Robinson and Temptations and Spinners.
Me and my brothers, we became celebrities because people knew that we were family. We like 16, 15, 16, and 17. We used to drive out to Southfield and show these people. Our cousins live in that house there.
They never saw me with no drugs. If there wasn't no call in my house telling, hey, tell Courtney Joe Blow's on the corner, or hey, can we come by and pick up a package? It didn't happen. It wasn't going to happen. They didn't see none of it. And all they needed to see me was with a lot of money.
It seemed like there was always bags of money coming and going in the house.
Just stacked almost to the ceiling, just a room full of money stacked to the ceiling.
Even as a kid, you're able to put together the fact that things I want, I can get.
Just being spoiled to death, getting anything that your mind could even think you wanted and more.
The doorbell rings, I get on the intercom and I ask, who is it? And the guy says, Joe Weaver. Now, I know Joe Weaver, I know he's a good friend of my father, and I know he's working with my dad and everything, so he goes on to explain to me that I need to tell my father that he's with Muhammad Ali. And I look out the window, and I see somebody's with Joe Weaver, and I'm like, okay, let me go tell father that Muhammad Ali's at the door. I try to tell my father, who's asleep basically, try to explain to him that Joe Weaver is saying that he's got Muhammad Ali at the door and that we gotta let him in. Father's having no patience. Tell Joe Weaver to see me in the morning. I don't got time for this shit. I go back and tell Joe that my father says he's not getting out of bed. And then the next morning, Joe Weaver comes back with a bunch of pictures of him and Muhammad Ali.
This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.
What really started the problem with us was me and Eddie started getting high of cocaine.
He just bought that 74 Fleetwood that blew him until he went and got 4 ounces of cocaine.
I had drove all the way to Texas. We ran out of cocaine. He said, well, let's turn around and go back. And another friend of ours, Huckabuck, he was with me at the time. And he was really mad at me and Eddie because he thought me and him was the two biggest fools in the world.
We get to ride, and they getting high. We had about maybe 100, 150,000 miles in the back seat with me. But Union, Missouri,
and state troopers pulled us over. But we couldn't hide the money because the money wasn't in no suitcase or no bags. We just had it spread it on the back seat. So he looked and see the money. So he get on the radio talking about we got three bank robbers. So the next morning, Milton Henry come and got us and we got out.
The problems in Missouri were small time compared to what happened in Pennsylvania. He was pulled over driving Courtney Brown's wife's Cadillac. In the trunk, state police found 11 pounds of heroin and 3 kilos of cocaine. Milton Henry got Eddie out of that jam too. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court dismissed the case after certain donations were delivered to Philadelphia by Courtney Brown.
I went into that foolishness. It was business to me. And family came first, and I could separate the one from the other.
He kept it so separate, and he's my little league baseball coach. He's my little league basketball coach. A lot of the kids from the neighborhood came by and played at our house. And, if you ask most of the kids I grew up with, their memories of my father would be him out shooting hoops with us.
And he'd throw the basketball, come on. I ain't too old, I'll whoop you, I don't care how you want. We used to sit there and play basketball. He used to bet me. He used to bet me that I couldn't whoop him. I never whooped him in basketball.
But any illusions anyone may have had about their new suburban lifestyle was shattered in March of 73 when the front page of the Detroit newspapers listed Eddie and Courtney as two of the city's kingpins.
Third grade, on my way to school, like every morning I walk out and I pick up the newspaper and I bring it back in the house. And the front page of it is a picture of Eddie's house and of our house. And the caption reads, Kingpin Eddie Jackson lives in lap of luxury, and the house to the left is his chief associate, Courtney Brown. And I read it, and I throw the paper back into the house, like always. And then me and Eddie walk to get on the school bus, and it hits me as I'm getting on the bus that everybody else just read the same paper. And
about the investigation that the feds had when they indicted all those guys. Now, I was running the house on Benson, and I was selling like anywhere from like $25,000 worth of quarters a day. And my name never came up in the indictment, so the indictment had to be kind of ephemeral, you know, a little short and compact, you know what I'm saying? They didn't know the whole story, it was a whole lot of people that didn't get indicted, man, that should have got indicted, but didn't.
When Courtney took his daughter to enroll in an elite private school, they knew just who he was.
So we went to Country Day. We get to Country Day, Junior was with us, and the guy opened up a folder. And I look in the folder, they got headlines, drug kingpin lives in Southfield. Let me tell you like this, I got enough money to send them anywhere in the world to school. And I've not allowed my daughter to be harassed or victimized by what something I may have did or may not did, because at the time I hadn't been convicted of anything.
One Christmas, my mother and father took us to Toys R Us, and you know, most kids have a shopping list or a Santa Claus wish list, but we didn't have a list. They just told us to pick out what we wanted. They didn't put a limit on how many toys to get or what toys to get. And me and my sister just went aisle after aisle, and then after we got a carload of stuff, that was Christmas. And
I had a little younger brother and sister. They used to come over to their house on the weekends. And when they used to come back home Sunday night, it's like they'd been in Macy's. They used to come home with bikes, bags of clothes. And I'm like, I wish I was younger so I can get some of this stuff too.
Like any good father, my father would pass out candy at Halloween, but he would keep a pistol at the bottom of the Halloween bag.
The Jackson trial finally came to a head, and nearly 30 of the 32 defendants were convicted on almost all counts. But incredibly, Milton Henry's legal maneuverings kept everyone free on appeal bond, and they kept right on going in the streets. In 1975, Eddie and Black Butch were arrested in Las Vegas for violating the terms of their bond by leaving the state of Michigan.
Well, I turned myself in April 1st, 1977.
Eddie Jackson got 30 years. Courtney Brown got 21.
I was immediately transferred to Atlanta Penitentiary, which was so-called hardcore. I mean, you had from baby snatchers to stealing the check to top mafiosos, families in the world.
I kept going on, and they came on me, and I got a revoked bail. So me and Eddie wound up at the same federal prison, which was Leavenworth. Leavenworth was, I used to watch that on The Untouchables, Walter Mitchell narrating. I never thought I'd grow up to go someplace like that. 40-foot wall, and they put me in there, and I said, my life is over, because you can't see out.
Eddie and Courtney's legal maneuverings continued from prison, and Eddie was finally released in 1984, with Courtney not far behind. The streets had changed since the early 70s. Detroit was a more violent place, and a new breed of teenage drug dealers like the infamous Young Boys Incorporated ruled the streets.
The atmosphere got younger, it got wilder, because I was a part of that scene. It's like everybody lost their mind. It just wasn't no honor no more.
I mean, it wasn't no central thing then. No one had really no connections, big connect like Eddie had. These guys had local connection, and they were local, and they, it wasn't no direction, nobody really, no leadership. It just...
That's the problem with drugs now. You got people still selling drugs, but they ain't like the horse traders we was back in the old days.
After only 18 months on the street, Eddie Jackson was arrested in a massive new indictment and sent back to prison for heroin distribution. Courtney Brown managed to maintain a lower profile, but he was still the field marshal. His son, Courtney Jr., was now old enough to learn more about the family business.
It's time my father got out of prison following the case with him and Eddie was in 84, which was at the exact time that I was starting college at WMU University.
If they got a good education and went to the right schools and got the right connections, they can make just as much money one way or they could the other way. If they become educated legitimately, and if he decided whatever he wanted to do, it wasn't going to be on my part saying, come on, join the club.
Running errands for his father in the late 1980s, Courtney Jr. got a unique perspective on the way the world really works.
My father once sent me to see some guys in New York, some banking guys, and they were like on 6th Avenue, right in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, and it's got these fancy offices and pretty secretaries and a stock market machine, printing out stock market quotes. And it looked like a legitimate brokerage firm. But you know, the real deal is when you go in the back, it's just a couple of old white guys sitting around a desk with a whole bunch of people bringing their money in. And what they were doing were, they were money launderers. Some people from Israel, there's some people from South America, there's some people from West Africa, and then it's myself. And we were all taking advantage of the services that these people in Lower Manhattan did. They were people that you could bring $200,000 of singles and $5 bills, and then they'd end up writing you a check from some company. Boom. And it's funny because at the same time I'm going to class and I'm taking economics and business 101 and marketing. You know, it's kind of the hypocrisy of the world because I'm like, that ain't how the real world works. The difference between corporate America and the narcotics world, that line is so much thinner than people really, really know.
Courtney Jr. eventually became a successful retailer and real estate developer. His sister is a lawyer.
Most people who start their businesses started from the money they save or family or relatives giving them their money to get started. In this case, I asked my father for some money to start a store in Harlem. I was fortunate enough that he had the resources, and he did, and it allowed me to live what I call the poor man Puffy's lifestyle. You know, I'm a 27-year-old African-American guy, store across the street from the Apollo. I made a lot of money at this store, but a lot of drugs, a lot of girls, a lot of escorts, a lot of limo rides. And the fortunate thing is, I was actually able to go back to my family again and get some more money to keep my business going.
The legacy of Eddie Jackson and Courtney Brown is a complex one.
Really, the only regrets was that that I got caught. It it showed me the I learned a lot. I got a chance to see a lot of the world.
But that's all I knew at that time. That's all we knew. Them was our role models. You know, that's not the road to take. You don't have to live like that. It's a better way today.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm tired of all these glorified snitches such as Frank Lucas standing up there beating their chests like they was hell of a fellas. And in the end, they turned out to be worse than women. So if you cannot handle the pressure and the weight, don't get in the game. If you got to tell on everybody you know, and your mama, your dad, everybody you know to get out of trouble, just stay doing what you do now, because that game ain't for you. Most people today you look at cannot handle the weight. Nicky Bonds, snitch. Frank Lucas, snitch. Where's the real ones? This is a story about a real one. From the beginning to the end, never telling on nobody.
You know, as I've grown older, I understand that the fact that I've been able to travel the world, the fact that I've, you know, hung out with Prince, Fortune 500 people, and I've been able to experience some things that just very few people on earth are ever going to be able to experience. And a lot of those things come from the fact of the lifestyle that my father and education opportunities, some of the things that he did allow me to do.
All these gangster movies on TV about they sending their kids off and it becomes successful and things like that. But this is the only black family I've seen do that. It really did it.
So I, you know, as a grown man, as a 46-year-old man, I understand that you take the bitter with the sweet. That me and my sister have often, you know, conversated, well, what would life have been like if father would have just, kept driving the bus? Who knows? You know, it wasn't in the cards. You know, it is what it is, and it was what it was.
It's no different than all of America, but for some reason, those who report to history have always left the blacks on the plantation, even in those type of activities. I don't see a great deal of difference, except that Kennedy was making a lot more money. Joseph Kennedy became an ambassador. Eddie Jackson didn't become an ambassador.
On the streets of Detroit, though, Eddie Jackson and his crew are still remembered as the best that ever did it. And the ties of friendship and family that started in Black Bottom and Paradise Valley so many years ago still hold strong.
We use crime as a commodity in terms of economics. You know, you ask yourself questions like tobacco. How many people died last year from tobacco when we started talking about the moral value of what Eddie Jackson and others do? I'm not condoning what they do. What I'm simply saying is that there are many on that playing field.
I don't separate our story from the story, really, I mean, of the history of any other immigrant group, the Jews, the Irish. I mean, as every group in America has attempted to go to the next level economically, the story of organized crime and narcotics has played a part in it.
And the jury is still out. We don't know what's going to happen to the African-American families that were involved with serious crime and their children.
These are the trials and tribulations that go on as a family goes from Black Bottom or Paradise Valley to working class jobs, to sometimes that bridge that takes that family into the professional world, into the entrepreneurial world, into the next levels and stratas of life. In our case, and in many other families in America, that bridge has been paid for by activities in the underworld.
This podcast is brought to you by American Dope. This American Dope podcast is part of the Motown Mafia series. Check out the other podcasts in this series. Log on to www.americandope.com and check out our store.